You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how to know propaganda when you see it and what to do about it. First, a definition, because sometimes propaganda is in the eye of the beholder. Propaganda, according to the Cambridge English Dictionary, is information, ideas, opinions, or images, often only giving one part of an argument, that are broadcast, published, or in some other way spread with the intention of influencing people's opinions. And that last part of the definition, with the intention of influencing people's opinions, is important. So what's the difference between a politician who spins the facts to suit them, or a journalist who quotes sources that only support one side of the truth, and a propagandist, as many believe Donald Trump is, who uses misleading information to alter our perception of the legitimacy of government institutions and the relationship of Americans to one another. Now, you may see the president's claims and opinions, conspiracies, and documented lies in some cases as necessary skepticism about government. But keep listening, because it's worth hearing about how corporations, social media influencers, and others use propaganda very effectively. As our guests join us, I'd like you to think about this. Can you tell the difference between spin or one-sided claims and true propaganda? Do you think the quality of our public debate is being influenced by propaganda? 651-227-6000 on whether you think you can tell the difference between spin or one-sided claims and true propaganda. 800-242-2828, whether you think the quality of our public debate is being influenced by propaganda. And you can reach me on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Tim Wise, is an essayist who writes about race and an educator and the host of the podcast Speak Out with Tim Wise. And he's with us today from Nashville, Tennessee. And Tim, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Corey Wimberly is with us. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He has a book coming out in November called How Propaganda Became Public Relations. A lot to talk about in that, too. He's in Edinburgh, Texas with us today. Corey, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
It's nice to be here. It's a good way to start the week and a good way to start off the first day of the fall. Right?
All right. I agree. So I'm going to ask you, Corey, I think the word propaganda triggers, I don't know, some image of a hammer and a sickle or Joseph McCarthy. But I think we're going to find out today that propaganda is not some Cold War artifact, right?
Right. I think that's what most people think of when they think of propaganda. They think of it coming from the state, and they think primarily probably of rogue states like Iran or North Korea. But the truth is that propaganda was first created, modern propaganda was first created at the turn of the century in the United States as a business function. And what happened was, after World War I, the Germans called their wartime communications propaganda. And Edward Bernays, one of the most, maybe two most important propagandists of the 20th century, came back from World War I and he said, look, we can't call what we do anymore propaganda. The Germans have given it such a bad name. He says, well, what I had to do, I'm paraphrasing, he says, what we had to do is develop new words for it. So the words I found are public relations council. So
wow.
In the period after World War I, what had been propaganda gets renamed as public relations. And it today is a central $15 billion part of large businesses.
Tim, listen to this tweet this morning when I put out a question, and I'd really love your insight on this. Nick tweets, we probably can't tell the difference. Propaganda is not just some big despotic poster. It's changed. Propaganda is here on our feeds. It's subtle. It's enmeshed in our social connections. And see prior questions about how it's made today to bypass critical thinking. What do you think about that? Does Nick have something there?
Well, of course, I think he does. But let me even go more basic and historic than that. You know, when I think about propaganda, I think about the transmission of messages for the purpose of furthering a particular political, ideological goal, and oftentimes also playing into the emotions. So I think about as a kid growing up, I don't know if this is still the case, but I know for those of us, I'm 50, almost 51. I know that for generations, right, there was this story we all learned about George Washington. If we knew anything about George Washington, what we knew was that he was so honest that when he cut down a cherry tree, he couldn't right. tell a lie. And he told his dad, "Daddy, I did it. I did it." Now, there is not a historian on the planet who actually believes that is true. It never happened. It is a completely concocted story. And yet it was something that was taught. What was the value, the purpose, the social function of the cherry tree story if it wasn't true? Well, the social function was to embed in our minds this idea that the founders were these incredibly brave, courageous, and really flawless individuals to whom we should always look up and hold in high regard. And more people knew that story than knew about George Washington's ownership of and cruelty towards people of African descent. More people knew about that than knew about the embedded white supremacy of the founders, which would cast aspersions upon them. That was propaganda value. And so recently, when there are all these conservative folks who got very upset about the New York Times 1619 Project,
right,
which looked
right.
at the centrality of slavery to the American experiment, but they're not upset about the implanting of entirely false facts for only these hyper-nationalistic purposes, which has been going on even before the invention, as you just heard in those great first remarks about the creation of propaganda. In some ways, we've been doing that even longer since the founding of the Republic.
Here, Corey, Tim has really put his finger on this, too, which is why I think it's difficult to even have a conversation that I hope is really informative about propaganda, because it's so politicized. And yet, as I say that, I have to imagine it's always been politicized. Yes?
Sure. Propaganda has always been a partisan endeavor. You know, that it's no coincidence that propaganda, modern propaganda, starts at the turn of the 20th century. There was a lot of problems with workers. You know, that in 1870, for instance, there were no national strikes. But during the 1870s, there were over 10,000 national strikes. So all through the late 1800s, we have, you know, depression and worker upset. And propaganda was developed as a way to try to govern, you know, the working classes and to create in them the kind of behaviors that were needed to create corporate hegemony in the 20th century. You know, it can be easy to forget that before the Civil War, Americans made 90% of what they consumed. But just a few decades later, that equation would almost be reversed. So how do we take all of these people who are upset and turn them or transform them into the kind of people who would buy products, work at factories, live in the cities, in a way that would support corporate hegemony? And the way that was done, in part, is through propaganda. So yes, its history has always been partisan. It's something that it's a kind of private government that someone pays for to govern others, to get them to do the things they want them to do.
Got it.
On their behalf.
Okay. So, Tim, does propaganda often have elements of the truth in it? And is that what is insidious about it? Because it has some kind of factual basis to it, which makes it all the more difficult to tease out what's real and what's propaganda.
Well, Corey would probably have a better take on that than I would, but I would say the odds are yes. I mean, I think as with any kind of mythology, which is somewhat what propaganda is, it's myth-making for the interest of national or corporate power or a combination of the two, has to have some recognizable elements of truth, or else it wouldn't be believable. You know, good propaganda you can't start off by saying, well, you know, the president is from is an alien from Venus. Like that's just not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you could try that, you know, but I mean, very
it's so
few
objectively wrong. Right, got it.
Right, I mean, it has to start with a premise that's just believable enough for the masses to accept it, and so you always have to, when you're fashioning myth, you always have to do that. So in my work, for instance, obviously I think a lot about the use of racialized propaganda throughout history, you know, and the way in which, if you go back all the way to the colonial period, the oldest political play in the playbook of American politics, even the colonial period, is rich white people telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. This was done in the colonies. It was done during the Civil War. It was done during the labor union movement to divide and conquer the working class. And the president does it now when he talks about brown folk coming over the border to, quote unquote, take your jobs, et cetera. Now, if there were no people crossing the border, right, if there was not, in fact, a significant influx in the last 20, 25, 30 years of brown skinned folk from the global south, none of this would work. So obviously there has to be immigration and there has to be certain demographic change that people can see in order for that propaganda and scapegoating and race politics to work. The fact that it's being hyped up and exaggerated and people are being blamed for problems they didn't actually create is a different subject, but it's all part of the way propaganda works. You take that kernel of truth, which says, hey, have you noticed things are changing? They're changing. Those people are now in your communities, and those people, you're having to read signs in Spanish, God forbid. And, you know, you've got, you know, the ethnic food aisle at the grocery isn't just pasta anymore like the 70s. You know, it's all kinds of food from brown people. You have to have a certain grain of truth in order to scare folks. And unfortunately, that's how race propaganda has always worked. You take the insecurities of the masses and you blame people for those who aren't actually to blame.
Okay, Tim, you just said something. I was just, as I was listening to your description, I was thinking, towards what end? And I think you just addressed that. Toward the end of scaring people, making them anxious and uncomfortable, so that what?
So that traditional power structures remain embedded and in place. So when rich white folks have told not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown, the point is to divide and conquer working people who have a lot more in common with each other. You know, white working people, black working people, people generally who are working class have a lot more in common with the global South and the working class folks who are coming to the country to work in working class jobs than they have in common with Bill Gates, than they have in common with, you know, Donald Trump and his golden toilet or whatever it is he has in his penthouse at the Trump Tower, right? Working class people have nothing in common with these rich people who they're being inclined or encouraged to identify with, as opposed to identifying with other working people from around the world.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about identifying and understanding what propaganda is. Our two guests are helping us with that in the midst of how many of us use social media, how many corporations use propaganda, how many politicians use propaganda. And I'm asking you whether you can tell the difference as a news consumer, as a voter, between spin or one-sided claims and true propaganda. I mean, complete this sentence. I know it's propaganda when. How would you fill in the blank there? And do you think the quality of our public debate is being influenced by propaganda? I think Corey and Tim will say yes to that. I'm really interested in what your view is on that as a news consumer. Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Corey, I want to address something. We got a call immediately from a listener named Paul who said, I think it's comical that MPR is doing a show on propaganda. Personally, I feel that MPR stands for Minnesota Propaganda Radio. I think we have to come right at this idea that news organizations that may report news stories that don't fit with your political view are not propaganda. Would you please speak to that? You don't have to listen. You don't have to absorb that news, but that doesn't make it propaganda. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's two things we can say about this to sort of ask what propaganda is and how you identify it at a more fundamental level. And then the other thing is why the news media has been cast as propaganda, you know, lately, why, you know, the journalists have been identified as enemies of the state. And I guess to the second point, which seems like more was your caller's interest, I would say that, you know, one of the things that Trump has done effectively is to create an anti-professional sentiment among his base. So his base are composed mostly of whites, mostly of men. They are people without college educations, evangelicals, rural folks, and he's created a real anti-professionalism in his base that he shares and that unites them. And the news media is largely a professional institution. It works on professional norms. It's based on reasoning, evidence giving, and consideration of the effects of things. And those are qualities that I think Trump sees that his opponents, many people in the Democratic base, hold very dear. And it's a way of kind of infuriating and insulting the Democratic base, a mutual enemy, by undermining those things that they hold dear.
Tim, we have a caller here who I think is also going to get at this. What do you do when you're watching or listening or absorbing news and information that you don't agree with? How do you know when it's propaganda? To David in St. Paul. David, what are you thinking about?
I mean, first of all, when people...
Tim, hang on one second. I just want to grab this call from David. Hey, David.
Oh, sorry, sure.
That's all right.
Yeah, my question was thanks for having me on, would be, at what point do... I believe that these news lines and these opinion shows have blurred the lines between opinions and news. And, if you have an ideologue stating their opinions, which aren't necessarily... people are accepting them as facts. And to me... that's just as much propaganda as some, they're kind of doing it on purpose to kind of slant people in one direction or not. And I believe that's led to the polarization in this country.
Okay, so David, this is a really good question, because what happens when you watch MSNBC in the evening or Fox News in the evening? You have opinioneering going on there. Tim, how should we understand that in light of a discussion about propaganda?
Well, I mean, the reality is there are still objective standards for determining what is true and what is false. And the fact that certain opinion sharers on a network might comport with what sounds like it is slanted doesn't mean that it isn't true. So, for instance, let me just give you an example. It is objectively true that the kinds of tax cuts that have been advocated by the far right for the last 40 years do not pay for themselves, ever, not once, not one example of those paying for themselves in the form of increased revenue, which is what they've been promising for 40 years, that the growth would be so amazing that tax receipts would go up and the tax cuts would pay for themselves. Now, it never happens. Mm-hmm. They can't give one example. So if Rachel Maddow says that, or if someone on MSNBC happens to point out the fallacy of trickle-down economics, they're going to have people on the right who are going to go, that's propaganda. That's just left-wing bias. No, it's fact. If reality happens to have a left-leaning bias, that is not the fault of MSNBC. It is not the fault of those of us who point it out. There is truth and there is fiction. It is not that hard to discern. The problem is that when even like a news reporter on, let's say, Fox during the daytime asks a question mm-hmm. of someone in this administration that simply challenges
yes.
the narrative of the MAGA cult at the rallies, the people scream and yell on social media, this person ought to be working for MSNBC. They're obviously a left-wing propaganda. No, they're a journalist asking a question. And if your administration's representative doesn't want to answer that question, that doesn't make that reporter a propagandist. That makes your administration and their spokespeople propagandists. That's the difference.
Tim Wise with us, if you've just gotten in on the show. He's an essayist who writes about race, and he's an educator, and he's host of the podcast Speak Out with Tim Wise. And Corey Wimberly is with us. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. And he has written about propaganda, has a book coming out on it in November called How Propaganda Became Public Relations. To the phones, to Dan in Shorewood. Hi, Dan. What are you thinking about on this?
Well, I just wanted to share what my definition of spin versus propaganda would be. I consider spin to be a more nuanced approach to an accepted fact. So you're trying to talk about the implications of something rather than propaganda would be an attempt to frame a conversation away from an opposing argument in such a way that it would preclude that argument's existence, that you'd have to set up cognitive dissonance to even allow that to enter your thought space.
Okay, so I think you're saying that propaganda is meant to obscure the truth, or spin is meant to obscure the truth?
spin is meant to interpret the implications of truth, whereas propaganda, spin is more of a reactive, whereas propaganda is typically
proactive. Got it. Corey, do you agree with that?
I think that the things he's talking about definitely point to things that happen on a day-to-day basis. I think it's a perceptive comment and thinking about the different nuances of the way that truth is dealt with in our society. But I think, you know, from my perspective studying it over the longer term, that if propaganda was easy to identify and easy to see, it wouldn't be effective. And I also wouldn't have anything to write about in a book, right? Mm-hmm. I could put it all on a single page. One of the things that I found out that is very about propaganda and what it is, that's very different than what most people assume, I think, is most people think propaganda is primarily about deception and lies.
Yeah.
But what I found going all the way back to 1900 is there's a lot of worry about that strategy amongst propagandists. They're afraid that if they lie, that it will be found out, it will ruin their campaign, whatever they were arguing for, and it'll leave their client untrustworthy in the public eye. You could think of something like what happened with Volkswagen and the Dieselgate scandal is just this kind of nightmare unfolding that left, you know, their spokespeople, their presidents, the company as a whole, mm-hmm. deeply untrustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that there's another strategy that they tend to prefer that's different than lying. So lying isn't actually, I think, what they hope to do. They have another strategy that they hope to employ.
Which is?
Well, so the goal is, and this is really rather insidious, I thought, it's kind of fun in that way, if I could be permitted to say that, is that the goal is to transform who people are such that they want the same thing that the propagandists want them to want. Let me offer you an example. Like, I might go out and buy designer clothes, but it's probably not today because I'm deceived about them. You know, if I go out and buy designer jeans, it's not because I believe they have some superpowers that I've been lied about. I buy those jeans because they're integral to my identity. I see myself as the kind of person who wears Levi's jeans and drinks a Miller Lite, or wears Lululemon pants and has yoga pants and has Chardonnay in the evening.
Uh-huh.
I buy them not because I'm deceived, but really more because I've been brought to see myself as the kind of person for whom those activities are integral for who they are.
I become
the kind of person they want me to do, and I just do those things because it's who I am.
Tim, you wanted to add?
I was just going to say that the emblematic example of this, you know, back when the second Gulf War began, right, when we began the bombing of Afghanistan and then later Iraq, you know, you had all these guys, and it was mostly guys, who were going out buying Hummers, right? There was this moment for Hummers as a vehicle. Now, Hummers are the, like, most gas-guzzling, wasteful, polluting, horrible, you know, vehicles on the road. They're actually emblematic of the problem that then tries to get solved by going to war to fight for oil because they burn so much gasoline and they're so incredibly inefficient. But it was a way for the guys who got them, you know, some of whom felt like this is my way to support the military because I drive something that looks like a tank. But what is that about? Like, what kind of incredible psychological malformation would allow you to think, well, the reality is the people who make the Hummer or similar tank-like vehicles knew that they could tap into this hyper-nationalistic, patriotic feeling and sell a lot of Hummers to guys who felt that that would bring them closer to the soldiers, which is absurd on a million levels. But if it didn't work, they wouldn't have done it.
But it
clearly did work for at least a few years.
And it doesn't sound like propaganda to me. It sounds like advertising influence and psychological recognition about what's appealing at a certain moment in time when we're talking about advertising. Tim?
Right. Well, and it is that. But I think what makes it propaganda is it ties into this national narrative, right?
So if it were just
advertising, it would just be like, hey, go buy this because it's a really cool car. But when you tap into this nationalistic narrative, right, that links it to the interest of the state and the guardians of the state, and in this case, the national security state, then to me, that's when it sort of leaps from just regular advertising, like what we see on the Super Bowl, people do ads, into propaganda, at least for me.
Tyler says on Twitter, maybe it's always been this way, but today it seems that a situation happens then someone with access to the media is allowed to spin and lie, and then social media breathes the life into the lie, creating propaganda. Then the original fibber cites the propaganda to back their claim. Corey, does he kind of have the life cycle of propaganda right there?
Well, a colleague of mine, Megan Hasicka at Northwestern, she writes a lot about this exact phenomenon, propaganda. And she calls it siloization, where people's language, references, and ideas become closed off from the rest of the world and become self-referential. And one way I think she thinks that we can tell that we live in a time of high polarization and a lot of propaganda is the way that the right seems to be speaking mostly to the right and the left seems to be speaking mainly to the left. We can go even deeper than that. You know, people from different subcultures seem to be closed in on themselves and their ideas get to be self-referential and self-reporting. So I think that is a feature of modern times and contemporary discourse, this kind of polarization and siloization.
Yeah, I want to address something here. Linda called and she had to drop the line, but she said, I know it's propaganda when I watch news from different states and they have the exact same story. The other day, I saw stories in Minnesota that said someone has died from vaping. Then I saw news from Texas, and that was their lead story for the day, too. I think the tobacco industry is trying to put an end to vaping. I mean, vaping has been going on a long time. Why focus on it now? Tim, my understanding of why that made the news was that there was new research and a warning coming out from the CDC. But
right.
But I think we're seeing, again, some confusion about what propaganda is and how it fits into daily journalism.
Yeah, I don't know that the fact that a story is taking place in two states automatically makes it propaganda or imbues it with some semi-conspiratorial thing on the part of the tobacco companies. I don't think it's certainly not outside the realm of the possible. Certainly, we know that tobacco companies and other corporate giants have manipulated public opinion for a lot of reasons.
Oh yeah,
and the tobacco industry certainly one of the bigger ones. But the reality is, people have died from vaping. Now the question is whether or not that is, you know, let's say, worthy of national congressional action, whereas gun violence is not. You know, 8, 9, 10 people, whatever, have died from vaping. That's obviously a problem. There are some unanswered questions. Thousands of people upon thousands of people die either at their own hands or the hands of others using guns, and we don't even study gun violence. That, to me, is a bigger issue. But, you know, the fact that a story gets covered in multiple states doesn't make it false or propagandistic, except I will say, you know, we have all these stations that are now owned by Sinclair, and there is a literal corporate edict from Sinclair Broadcasting that they have people at all their stations around the country who are required to do certain stories, who are required to have Sebastian Gorka or whomever it's not Gorka, it's one of the other Trump people, do a commentary, every week or so, that sort of puffs up the administration. Now that, I think, if you've got Sinclair stations or you've got various stations owned by a company and they're all running similar editorial content on Friday afternoon or Friday evening, then I think we're talking about what would qualify as propaganda.
Yeah, and by the way, for listeners who think that's propaganda, it's not. It's documented, and I think Sinclair has admitted this, Tim. I think they have said this is editorial policy. Right.
Yeah.
And the reason that we don't study gun violence is because Congress passed a law that says it's not going to fund an organization that studies gun violence, right?
Right, right.
Okay. That's not propaganda either. I mean, that is a fact. There is
right.
a law that does not fund an organization that previously funded gun violence. So you can see that this is a complicated topic here this morning. We're talking about propaganda. I'm asking you this morning if you can tell the difference between spin, one-sided claims, true propaganda. And I'd love to hear you and our listeners as well and our guests as well about how the quality of our public debate is being influenced by propaganda, not just in the political realm, but that too, but how corporations use this and how other organizations use this. 651-227-6000. Anywhere in our five-state region here, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at @CarrieNPR. To the news now, and then back in a minute for your calls and questions. Back to our conversation. Corey Wimberly is with us from the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. And Tim Wise is with us, host of the podcast Speak Out with Tim Wise. And to the phones, to Derek in Eagan. Hey, Derek, thanks so much for waiting. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Carrie, for taking my question.
Yeah, what do you want to say?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking a lot about propaganda this weekend. Beto O'Rourke, a couple weeks ago or last week, said he's going to take everyone's ARs.
Yep.
And of course, if you listen to public radio or any mainstream media source, you'd think that, man, guns, it's an epidemic. The FBI says there's about 30,000 gun deaths a year. 22,000 of those are suicides. I bet your listeners didn't know that. How about this? How many rifle deaths are there a year? 400. You know how many deaths there are from preventable deaths in hospitals? 210,000 a year. So when people talk about propaganda and whipping up the masses and giving people one side of the story, I really wish people would talk about how many gun deaths. Your last guest, your guest there in the studio basically mentioned, you know, why isn't there gun legislation? Maybe because gun legislation accounts for about 5,000 homicides a year that aren't suicides nationwide, or a little bit more than that.
But Derek, I have to say this, that when we've had conversations, and by the way, I've seen this and read this in many other sources, there are often statistics about how many gun deaths are attributable to suicide. So I don't think it's right to come on and say, nobody knows that, it's never reported, and it's really just all about taking everybody's guns away. It's whether the news consumer would like to absorb or has the interest in absorbing that kind of information. I see that reported in a lot of places. Did you want to say something else, Derek, on that?
Yeah, I guess all I'm saying is the proportionality. If 210,000 people die every year from preventable deaths in hospitals, and only 7,000 or 5,000 die from gun deaths, where should the legislative focus be? On guns, a constitutional right, or maybe cleaning up the hospitals? I mean, well, this is all I'm saying is that's where the propaganda comes in.
I guess, Tim, what I hear in that is like two things can be true at the same time. What do you hear?
Yeah, I mean, can I say something to this?
Please do.
First of all, I find it fascinating because when people jump in to say how rare gun deaths are, let's say homicides in particular, they're correct. We actually live in a far less violent society than some on the right who usually defend guns would have us believe. They're the ones who say America is this dangerous place filled with carnage, and that's why I need my gun to defend me and my family from the marauding bands of criminals who are breaking in to everyone's house and raping and killing them. The reality is that the lower homicide rate and the falling violent crime rate, it's fallen by over half, for example, since the early 1990s, are precisely why weapons like that aren't necessary to, quote unquote, defend one's family. And when you look at states like Missouri as just one example, which several years ago passed a guns everywhere law, even though previously it had been much harder in the state of Missouri to get a weapon, and they have seen an explosion of suicide deaths. They haven't seen an explosion of using guns defensively to stop criminals, because as the caller intimates, that kind of thing really isn't that common. But people who are inclined to potentially end their own lives now have a much easier and quicker way to do it, because it is much easier and faster to do that with a gun than any other method. So the question is, if crime isn't really out of control, if people aren't just breaking into houses and killing people, thus necessitating guns in self-defense, then perhaps that suicide explosion ought to be a good reason to study gun violence, and ought to be a really good reason to make it more difficult, not easier, to get a weapon. So I think that the caller's argument sort of eats itself in a way, and actually undermines the very basis for what he's trying to say.
Corey, and to this question of people, I also think Derek was trying to say people are forming opinions on when they are missing some of the facts. And my argument was, but the facts are out there, especially on this issue, and often they're not influential because people already have held opinions. Maybe you want to add something to that. I'm being careful about the way I'm saying that. What would you add?
Sure. I think you're right about that. I think that the gun industry is an example of an industry that has had great propaganda. And I don't think we need to think about that in terms of it's constantly pumping sort of lies out into the public. I would say this, what it's done very effectively is get people to see gun ownership as a fundamental part of their self-identity. And so people, when they think of themselves, they think of themselves as gun owners. It's an integral part of who they are. And that's very difficult to challenge with facts and information. When somebody perceives a particular product or set of actions as a key part of what makes them who they are, it can be very difficult to have, you know, for facts and information to sort of penetrate that because they perceive it as being so integral, you know, as being so integral to who they.
But you know something, Corey, I think the news media makes that a lot worse because soccer moms, gun owner, you know, very slick kind of labels that don't say anything about the complexity of how somebody has come to their decisions about a political stand.
Sure. You know, you see this in I visited all the archives of all the early propagandists. I read their working papers, how they train their workers, how mm-hmm. they commented on their works in progress. And one of the things you see them talking about is they don't actually want to involve facts, information, and arguments and how they motivate or influence public opinion. Because once you start giving facts or making arguments, you give people the space to make counter-arguments. So these kind of slick ways that you're talking about is packaging identities or lifestyles and making their products or the activities they want to make integral to those lifestyles integral. That's really the way a lot of it works. And that happens at a level that's really below the level of critical thinking or even reason. The aim is just sort of to unconsciously embed in people a sense that whatever the propagandist client wants them to do is a key part of their personality, is a key part of who they are, an essential part of
their identity. There's a really good example of this regarding guns from several years back. Bushmaster, which is one of the big gun manufacturing companies, did it. They had an advertising campaign that essentially consisted of a picture of an AR, and it said, get your man card back, you know, essentially saying, if you buy this weapon, you'll get your man card back because we know you've been feminized, you know, by modern culture. So this killing machine will essentially make you more of a man. That is peak propaganda, you know, and it's a very effective campaign because it speaks to people's emotional needs, not rational thought, not intellectual thought, not facts about whether one needs this particular weapon, but the idea that this substitutes for some lack of masculinity. If I have the capacity, even if I never use this thing, if I have the capacity and I simply own it, it makes me more of a man. There is something horribly insidious, but horribly effective, precisely because it operates on the emotional level as opposed to any sort of fact-based or rational level.
You know, Corey, what Tim just described there reminded me. I know you've done a lot of work on the genealogy of propaganda. And one of the people that I think you were reading was about Gustave Le Bon. Is that right?
Yeah.
And isn't it true that Le Bon saw how effective propaganda would be in a culture of grievance, which is kind of the culture that we live in right now? What did he understand about that?
Well, Le Bon thought, you know, he's French, and one of the things that he was mourning was the loss of the French aristocracy, right? We've lost our best leaders, is what he thought. He was a right-wing French thinker, royalist in large part. And, you know, the question for him was, how in a democracy people are given formal control over the government, over the election of the government and over their lives, how we can undermine that and reassert elite control.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you see a lot of that in the United States today, that just at precisely the moment at the turn of the 20th century, when enfranchisement is growing in a lot of ways, women are going to get the right to vote soon, that there is a push for greater mechanisms of control of how the public thinks, how the public acts, and ultimately how the public votes.
Let me take a call here from Eric in Chisholm, Minnesota. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thanks for waiting. What do you want to add to this?
Well, a couple different things. When earlier, I don't forget if it was Corey or Tim said something about the Hummer and how, you know, if you bought a Hummer, you would be closer to the military, you know? I mean, it's the same concept that, you know, people believe it would be that close to the military. It's the same concept as, you know, religion. You know, if you practice this, you'll be closer to God. So people, I mean, ultimately, everything seems to be based on human emotion right now. Uh-huh. People are giving in to irrational feelings. Even, you know, they look at a small piece of the pie, you know, and they don't look at the whole picture. And the whole picture is the facts, you know, what's actually going on and who the people actually are. They take a couple people who've done bad things, and they label the whole group of people. And that's what's been going on, is everybody's been getting labels so they can divide and conquer everybody. No one stands together anymore because they put labels on everything. And you can blame the left and the right for that.
Yeah. Tim, if I might, Eric, those are some interesting observations. Is that an effective part of successful propaganda, what Eric just described?
Well, labeling certainly is, right? If I can create labels to sort of collectively identify people who may have a few things in common, but might also have a lot of things quite a bit different about them, then it becomes easier to scapegoat them, to demonize them, right? So if I'm on the right and I can call everybody to my left a communist or a socialist, right, that's a very easy label. If I'm on the left and I conclude that everyone to my right is a fascist or whatever, then that's a label. And again, these, you know, our brains, sadly, as humans, we think they're very evolved. We think we're very higher order species, but our brains have not evolved nearly as well as we believe to be able to actually take in information. What the research says is most of our politics, most of our ideology is rooted in emotional reactions based on personal experience. So, you know, people who are running for office need to think about that. When you're out there trying to run for office, talking about, look at all my 10-point plans for this policy or that policy, look at all my platform positions, and you actually think that that is how people make decisions, you're not paying attention. And this is one of the things that I've always thought that people on the left, frankly, need to get very clear on. I'm obviously of the left, and the thing that drives me crazy about people on my side who run for office is we treat everything like it's like we come at politics like the debate team from high school. And the other side comes at politics like the cheerleading squad and the pep club. And I got news for you. There's a reason the cheerleaders were more popular in high school than the debaters. And I say that as a former debater. I'm not bitter.
Funny.
I'm 50. I've gotten over it, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that the reason is that nobody likes being told how stupid they are, which is what sometimes politicians do they give you the 20-point, you know, stuff. But they like being told how correct they are, how right they are, how their values are proper. And it's sad that we don't look at facts and information, but that's where the species is right now. So people better be clear on that if they want to be able to exercise power effectively.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't mention that you've run political campaigns. You really know what you're talking about here. Corey, have you written a chapter in the forthcoming book on McCarthy? And what do we, again, it seems like an artifact of history, but we did a show a while back and I went back to read something about how Joseph McCarthy, how he was so effective. And it seems like it's relevant to today.
Sure. You know, and I think your last caller kind of touched on, you know, some elements of this question, too, as well. He was really, I think, perceptive at seeing how political discourse has changed over time. You know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I remember reading a story of a Lincoln-Douglas debate, and they each gave an opening speech of a couple hours. They had a half an hour response to each other.
Wow.
Then they sent the crowd home for lunch. The crowd returned and they spoke for several more hours about issues.
Uh-huh.
And you compare that to today, where in the presidential debates, I don't remember exactly, but I think you know, the people had about a minute to respond.
Yeah, in one of the first debates. That's right.
Hours to a minute. And, you know, it's a good question to ask, like, sort of, when does that happen? Where does that happen? Is it McCarthy? Is it some other time? And my two cents on that is really that the norms of commercial speech, of corporate speech, are leaching from business into politics. We're talking more and more about politics like we talk about selling a product. You know, buy this weight set now, you'll look like Adonis in just 30 days. And those are that's the same kind of way that people want to talk about policy ideas and candidates.
But tell me what the connection is.
Speech.
Yeah, Corey, tell me what the connection is with the McCarthy era, though.
Well, one of the interesting things is that propaganda really picks up first in business. The Democratic Party is the first party to hire a full-time propagandist, and they don't do so until 1929. But as time goes on, and especially through the Great Depression with FDR, politicians really begin to learn how to use mass media, the new communication techniques, a nationwide news network, in order to influence opinion. Mm. And McCarthy is just maybe an extreme example, but an extension of the growth of corporate techniques for governing public opinion into the political realm.
Interesting. Hmm. Let me grab a call here from Jane in Duluth. Jane, I only have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to make sure to get to you. What do you want to add?
Well, I'll make this quick. I'm trying to put a positive, pardon the pun, spin on this.
Okay.
When I was high school science teacher there and teaching AP environmental science, there's a lot of controversy. We were starting to study global climate change, mm-hmm. and people were very skeptical. And I remembered a little acronym that I learned from a professor I worked with at a college years before. It's called SOFIA. It's the name of it's a woman of wisdom. It's a Greek word for wisdom. And what I did is I gave them this they had to deconstruct the news because high school students want to take a shortcut to everything. This is a good shortcut to learning about how to read something critically.
Okay.
So S in SOFIA stands for source. The New York Times wrote it. Well, who in the New York Times? Did it come across the AP? They had to look at the real source. O is opinion. Is this an opinion piece or a fact piece? If it's a fact, you got to learn the difference. If it's an opinion piece, toss it out and find something
else.
I'm
running out of time here, Jane.
Black. SOFIA is FLAC. That's the F sound, FLAC.
Okay.
I is information. Is it accurate or not? And then A is access. Who has access to it and what's the application meant for?
Okay.
So it's just a little thing to help people, if they're willing to, especially students, unwrap the news. That's all. And it worked. And the kids who won the debate found the behind the scenes of all this stuff was sponsored by corporate interests and not science.
Source, origin, FLAC, information, access. Corey, Tim, thank you very much for working your way through the hour with me. I hope we shed some light on this. I really appreciate your contributions here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!